So, I'd like to begin then by just asking Samantha Badri about your experience of matter, about your earliest experiences of matter, or indeed anything that you'd like to say in terms of how matter has been present for you.
I'll say something about my earliest experiences of metta, because when I came to the movement from quite an isolated situation, so I was only contacting meditation and meditation teaching at times. And well, all of that teaching had a very big effect on me, and the teaching of the Metta Bhavana had a big effect on me. But it wasn't that I was having wonderful meditations. What it was that I was just kept doing it again and again, and I had a sense of change. I knew that I was changing. It was my last year of teaching in the comprehensive before going to a sixth form college, and the whole texture of that year felt different. And others noticed it. Others noticed that I was changing. And this, that sense, well, actually the texture of the day would feel different, and I could feel as though I was moving in a different rhythm. So I feel a lot of gratitude actually for that early teaching.
Yes, I think that when I first came to Buddhism, which was about 10 years ago, I think probably metta was the very first thing that I was aware of, although I couldn't really articulate it. So I walked into the Manchester Buddhist Centre about 10 years ago, and I'm very sensitive to space and place, and I had a real sense of something positive in the air. And I think, of course, I don't know because it's not a just a question of knowing something, but I sensed that that was concerned with matter, and I was very drawn to it. And then later on, when I began to get to know people in the Sangha, again, I think matter was the very first thing that I felt and I experienced. I was attracted to. Yes, and it's something that I also wanted to cultivate very strongly, not quite knowing at the beginning how to do that, of course, but I was very drawn to it. Yes.
I mean, we have a kind of particular way of being with each other, don't we? When it's informed by metta, when it's part of the Sangha, we get used to it, and we don't get used to it actually, but it's just a different kind of connectedness and connection.
Yes, I think that well, my own experience of matter is that it's a very subtle experience. It's not so much, there may be grand gestures, but often for me, it's not about the grand gestures, it's about the subtle connection between people. And I think I'm particularly aware of this. We'll go on to talk about this maybe in everyday experience, but also particularly aware of it on retreat, particularly when a retreat is coming together, as we all are now. And there's that current, I think, between us, which I see very much as part of the current of matter, which can be fostered between us.
Yeah, we're talking about something special, aren't we? And something precious, and something very true and alive and in the nature of things.
Yes. I mean, I've had this. And I was thinking about this talk and thinking about, well, what is this experience of matter? And I'm a bit of a metaphorical person, so forgive me if that's not your thing. But I sometimes have that image of matter as being a bit like the sun flooding a landscape, really. Or maybe even in a more subtle way, just glimpses of the sun coming through. And in the sense that it's fostering our positive qualities and a positive way of being, I think. I think it goes back to your point that you have just made, that it can change the texture and the feeling tone of our day very, very quickly in the smallest gesture.
And it changes us,
Yes,
as I was saying, and it has changed us, and it continues to change and transform us. So it's maybe we could almost tease out a little bit more about actually about what we're talking about. So we're saying metta, we're saying it, but what are we actually, what am I actually talking about here? And one thing which I often say on retreat and is important to say is Well, metta isn't an emotion, is it? Primarily, it's not an emotion. It's actually, well, what we call a volition. It's a momentum, it's a tendency, it's the way that we wish to be, isn't it? So we've got to be careful when one does it, and it's understandable that we fix it in terms and nouns, but actually it's a flow, it's a momentum.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think sometimes, so we talk about it in terms of, well, a volition, don't we? A willing. And you've often talked about it as not being a feeling. And I, for me, that was when Samantha Badri said to me quite a long time ago now, when I was having strife in the Metta Bhavana, about metta not being a feeling, but it was a volition. I found that really, really helpful, actually, because feelings can come and go, and we probably have millions of feelings in a given day, which are as changeable as the weather. So for me, thinking about it in terms of a willing is very important, and that we set our intention. Maybe we set our intention at the beginning of the day when we dedicate our day and our space to practice of the Dharma. But yes, setting our intention to be metaful, and of course, it's not a stick to beat ourselves with, so we'll get it wrong, probably on a pretty regular basis. But we have a kind of, there's a sort of keeping faith, I think, as well in that process of keeping faith with our skillful intention to try to be metaful towards each other.
Yes, and well, we may have very positive experiences when we're doing the meditation practice, and you know that's very good. It's not just about that. If it was just beautiful experiences on the cushion, then it would have limited value. If those good experiences then become part of us being kinder, actually, just being kinder and having that flow of positivity, then obviously it's contributing to that. But this, as we say, is about change. It's about how we live our lives, isn't it? And it's our meditation practice setting us up to do it. Which also means, and this comes back to me in the early days, but I think it means, well, actually, you can be also on the cushion and not having great experiences. And it's of value. And we come back and we do it again and again. We go back into that room this week and we do it again and again. And that has consequences. That's the power of transformation. Really, and we will notice that, or others will notice it, you know, at unexpected times, really.
So would you say that your experience of the Metta Bhavana practice has been a really important part of your practice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I can certainly say for myself, without getting into too much detail about the practice, that for me it's been... it's been a very strong practice. It's a practice that I've struggled with. But I also have had some strong experiences, particularly with the difficult stage in the practice, which has really transformed some very... I don't go out trying to have difficult relationships with people, but these things happen, don't they, in the friction of everyday life. And certainly I've had a very strong experience where the difficult person stage with patient and not unpleasant effort has changed around my relationship with somebody, which was really quite difficult. So I at that point, and that was some years ago, I began to have an extraordinary respect for the Metta Bhavana practice. I think prior to, I just sort of gone in and thought, oh, this is kind of good for me and I shall do this. But I think thereafter I realised that, well, it is a revolutionary practice, really. So it's a Bhavana practice, so we're cultivating metta, but also that can have profound changes in our being that we cannot know about, really, and we may not necessarily see the consequences of for some time.
And yes, and it's about our relationship with others, isn't it? It's about our relationship with all beings. It's about living,
And if we think a little bit about our experience of metta off the cushion, would you be willing to say something about your ordinary experience of metta?
Yes, I when I picked up Kane the City on Thursday, we went to a cafe, we were waiting to pick up Tara Cunha, and I think I said to you then, I can kind of imagine if I achieved insight, it might well be in a cafe. And it doesn't mean I keep going to cafes again and again for achieving insight, but and that would happen on the basis of lots of other work, wouldn't it? And it would happen on the basis of lots of work on the cushion as well. But something in the end about just being in the ordinary and in the real and just being with ordinary people, as I'm an ordinary person, you know, just... So that is what, that's where I often feel the benefits of my practice, really. And it is just looking at somebody, you know, looking at somebody sitting there reading a book, or people often meet in cafes, so you're often looking at interactions as well. Things like looking at, well, actually mothers and daughters, grown older mothers and grown-up daughters often touches me, and I was once a grown-up daughter with my mother in cafes, you know, and you're seeing the sort of the play of life and connection, and people, well, just as they are, I don't need to know the detail, don't need to know the detail.
Yes, I think that's it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's often in the kind of the everyday hum of life that we can observe these little gestures, really, as you say, in everyday ordinary experience. And it's also a universal quality, isn't it? That it's something that we can just share with people, as you say, without needing to know a lot about them. I think perhaps that sometimes, well, certainly in my own case, metta has got a bit tangled up in the at times with unhelpful sort of sort of psychological processes and emotional stories, and actually I sort of have come to realise, and sometimes I forget, but that it can be a much simpler process, actually, that we don't need to know very much about somebody at all, or indeed anything, just to feel a simple flourishing of metta for them.
That's why the neutral person is important, isn't it? Why the neutral person is important in the meditation practice, and it's also that's also a good preparation for the final stage as well. You know, it is just, well, it's, we're not setting our preferences and our conditions, are we? We're just responding to another human being, as you're saying.
And of course that's also part of the first stage of metta bhavana, that we can that we can also have that sort of simple well wishing towards ourselves without getting tangled up in emotional or psychological stories. Although it is difficult sometimes, but yes, that it can be this very simple gesture. This kind of, sometimes I have this kind of image of metta as a kind of turning towards others, and a turning towards oneself in a very simple way, in a very kindly way, you know, just just in the same way that you might just help somebody out, you know, at a very simple level in everyday life, in ordinary experience.
Which is where the samskara, the tendency, is expressing itself, playing itself out, developing more, supporting what we're doing on the cushion as well. And well, similarly, when I do the practice, just coming on to the other stages, and possibly use this particular one more in the fourth stage, but when thinking about someone, a difficult person, I'll sometimes just think, well, actually they were once a little child, and one day they are likely to grow old, and they will be sick, and they will die. And so one's going towards the sort of deeper existential truth, and the deeper shared truth of all our lives, and letting some of the other details, which can also be more of our own interpretations, just kind of fall away.
Yes.
Really.
Yes.
You know, and we're all in the human situation together.
I think that becomes particularly apparent that that some of these sort of archetypal human moments that we can have that you mention, you know, at I was going to say birth, marriage, and death. That sounds a bit. But yes, these sort of life moments, these big life moments that we have, where sometimes things fall away, the complications in our lives just fall away, and we can see. They're moments of insight, I think, as well, aren't they? That we just see through to what's really essential, and that in that moment somebody just needs a little bit of kindness, or maybe a cup of tea, or whatever they might need, and we can see that sometimes. And it's really, it feels very, when I've seen that, it feels a very simple thing, uncomplicated, and one just responds.
Mm.
Yes. Thinking a little bit as well about, we've talked about imagination and this connection.
Mm.
So I suppose I was wondering whether you thought, what role you thought the imagination had in our metta practice.
I think it has a very significant part in it, and it's a bit like ideally metta is the feeling tone of imagination. In the practice, particularly in the meditation practice, well, we need to use imagination skillfully. Probably we need a kind of middle way with imagination, which means we're sort of actually aligning it with the truth of how things are, and the ordinary truths of how things are. So, you know, we don't want to be too imaginative, actually, and too creative, because then we will be probably going into something which takes us away from the truth. And if we don't have enough imagination, then it's going to be a bit dull and flat, and we're not involved enough. So something of a middle way there, which enables us just to be with the humanity of another human being or other human beings. And it takes, well, imagination traditionally is what enables us to perceive the truth of things, isn't it? We're using imagination in that sense.
Mm.
And in the practice, it is just taking us to the truth of another human being on that kind of existential level, or that might also just be imagining them, you know, taking their dog for a walk, or you know, getting on a train, or whatever, just living their lives as well. But in the fifth stage, you know, when you go out in the fifth stage, when I've gone beyond the world of Tarpaloka, and my next port of call is often Whitchurch, actually, but when I'm there, moving out into the world, I sometimes think, well, there's somebody, someone today is getting up and they're going to a funeral. You know, it's that kind of day for them. They're putting on their dark clothes and they're going to a funeral. Somebody is holding their newborn child. You know, they're just these significant human experiences happening. Mm-hmm. And then someone is kicking a football in a park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ordinary and it's alive and it's human, so it also really matters.
Mm. So in that experience of imagining that you've described, it seems as though it's the imagination anchored in the ordinary and in the universal.
Yes, that's good. Yes. And then, well, the ordinary is what we all inhabit and what we are, and then the ordinary can also be extraordinary, can't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's the wonder of the ordinary as well. If, you know, I suppose insight would be to see a teenager kicking a football in a park and just have a moment of wonder around it.
Yes, in that sense there's a sort of an illumination, isn't there, that happens, an illumination of ordinary experience, that we can witness the potentiality of the situation, and the sort of positive emotional tone of the situation as well.
Mm. And it might be witnessing seeing somebody suffering as well, so it's the whole, well, it's a whole panoply, isn't it, of human experience is playing itself out.
Mm.
And we're in it. We're part of it. It's playing itself out through us. And then also we're just kind of responding to it. We're seeing it as being touched by it.
Mm.
And because it's so related to the truth of things, that's transformative.
Mm.
And I mean, of course, also we're always working with our contrary mental states as well, aren't we? So, you know, this is going, we will all, you know, we're all working with tendencies to fix things, to be judgmental, to have very clear ideas about what people are like, and what they're doing and what they've done, and this kind of thing, both at the level of a good friend and a difficult person and so on. So this is going beyond those kind of responses, which just come from our ignorance, and they're going towards something deeper, and have faith in something deeper within us. And maybe that's where the, you know, the language of the heart comes in as well. You know, we use the language of skillful intention, and that's really important. But also it is deep in ourselves. We wish to wish others well, and we wish to be kind, to be generous, to be in a flow of connection with others.
Yes, I mean, it seems to me that it's... it goes against those sort of tendencies for delusion, as well as sort of aversion and attachment as well. That we're working with a simpler gesture towards others in a way. And I was thinking just while you were speaking that it's also, if we're thinking about metta as a path to a bigger picture for living, that it's in a sense, to me, it's maybe more akin to a way of being rather than a sort of way of having. So it's not that we want anything from the situation, actually. But it's, we're just being with, we're being with the situation, we're being with this person or these people. We're being with our retreatant friends.
Bhante calls it a creative orientation of being. And it is simple. I mean, we complicate things, don't we?
We make our lives complicated by wanting things and disliking things and trying to fix the world in a way it won't be. And if one was able to kind of go beyond that, then it becomes...
Well, it becomes a flow, it becomes about connection, not separateness.
And that creative orientation of being, it seems to me that part of the reason why it's creative is it is because it's working with the truth of how things are in the present moment. So we're a bit like your example in the cafe, we're just in the presence of the stuff of life, aren't we? And responding to that in the moment, yes, rather than having, you know, fixed ways of response, yes. Perhaps then this is a suitable time in our sort of conversation to think about metta in relation to the larger vision, and maybe talk a little bit about the connection to, you know, and actions, so suffering, impermanence, and insubstantiality.
Yes, I mean it's the path to insight, isn't it? It's a major part of the path to insight, because if we define insight as a going beyond self, then all the sort of outgoingness that we've been talking about is that moving beyond self and one's own particular preferences and the conditions we'd like to have in one's life and all of that kind of thing. It's going beyond that. So it's part of the path to insight. And as we let go of our self-concern, our self-clinging, our self-preoccupation, then obviously we see the bigger picture. We see the panoply of life playing itself out. We see the truth more. So we will see impermanence, you know, that somebody was once a little child and one day they will be old and sick. And we'll see insubstantiality, I think, as well. We'll see the playing out of connectedness. None of us can exist on our own. And we're mutually dependent and dependent on life in all kinds of ways. But I think also the third of those lakshanas, third of the aspects of how things are, unsatisfactoriness is interesting here, because that's also what we share. You know, we all live in a world which is unsatisfactory. We all live in a world which will involve suffering. We all live in a world which does go wrong for us. And we all make mistakes as well. We all make a mess of things at times. And if our metta can hold that, you know, hold the fallibility, I think the mutual fallibility, because it's so easy to get into blame and self-righteousness and judgments and so on. And when we let go of things, then we are looking much more towards the insight aspects. So that's my response. But would you like to add to
that? Yes, I would. I mean, that links a little bit to we're sort of trying to let go of wrong views as well. So we're letting go of wrong views to be much more with the truth of how things are. And yes, in that sense that setting a skillful intention really in relation to that unsatisfactoriness that we can't make samsara work for us. Sadhanandi has a lovely phrase for this, which is polishing the wheel of life, and trying to get it work for us. And if we just tweak a bit here and tweak a bit there and tweak a bit there, it'll kind of work well enough. I guess as we move through our experience and we realize that doesn't actually happen. The truth of things is actually there is unsatisfactoriness, however we try to set it up. And so in that respect, cultivating as a ground of metta helps us work with that, actually, I think.
Yes, and well, we're in samsara, aren't we? We're in conditioned existence, we're in the ordinary, which is all of what we've just said, and how things are at that level. And that is also where, you know, we will achieve insight. That's where things will also become illumined. You know, so you can hold something with a vision of there's no word for it actually, but the coexistence or the interpenetration or whatever of samsara and nirvana. And this is our working ground. This is where we practice. This is where we are kind. This is where we are helpful. And this is what can become profoundly transformative.
Yes, and I think that there are times then perhaps that we can just sort of begin to see the sort of shimmer, the kind of shimmer of conditioned co-production, can't we? We can begin to step back from our own agendas and see conditions rising and falling.
Yes, and also, in meditation as well, I don't think this is a very unusual experience, but one, particularly for one's in a space which is more formless in meditation, and I can sometimes feel that is charged with positive emotion. You know, it's just as though metta is also just part of the ultimate nature of reality. Yeah, and it's just there. And in periods like silence, one can also feel that.
Yes, it goes back to something that we were saying near the beginning of this conversation about walking into a space and having a sense of the atmosphere. I know that whenever I arrive at Taraloka, and often in this room, maybe before a retreat is beginning, or after a retreat has just ended, or in the shrine room, we have that sort of sense of a very positive tone. And there's something in the room that is beyond us, which is beyond our sort of knowledge of things, because we don't really know what's going on, do we? And we can be very receptive to that. And for me, I do connect it with that ground of the emotional positivity of metta that you talk about. Yes.
Bhante talks about it. It can be a medium within which consciousness can dwell. There's mystery there.
There is mystery there,
but that's exciting.
Yes.
You know, we can place our faith, we can place our heart in that.
Yes. Yes, and I think that it is an aspect of faith as well, isn't it? Trusting in our practice, trusting in the metta practice that that it can have positive consequences. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Just all those moments of human contact.
Mm.
Yes, all those little passing moments which we'll also experience very much this week.
Yes, I think we notice this very much, don't we, on retreat, where we come together for a short time and then we go our various ways. Not yet, not for a few days. Got many days of practice ahead of us. But and what we share, and we may well not know very much about each other by the time we leave, but what we will have shared will be very profound. And it'll be that, part of it, I think, will be that current of metta that we've established between us, and that well-wishing towards each other, whatever our individual life circumstances might be, and to which we will, you know, return.
Yeah. And just probably to finish this conversation, really, but in the end, the practice is working if we are kind. Really, or kinder than we were before, and others benefit, and we benefit.
Mm. Thank you.
Thank you.